That's one of my favorite phrases in a song, "O you who are weary of sin." What a power in that. Two things I want to announce before we get into the lesson this evening. One is, this is going to be one of a series on evidences that I did in Columbus, Indiana, a few weeks ago. And another one of these I'm going to be doing probably on Sunday night, September 2nd. And I'd like to encourage you to invite people to that. If you've got a friend that's agnostic or unbeliever, or a believer that would like to hear a sermon on evidences, it's a lesson. It's some new material that I had been working on to present here. And when the opportunity to do this other thing came up, I went ahead and presented it there. But I'm going to be doing it here now. And there's all sorts of things in nature that you can go to illustrate in Romans 1:20, the seeing the invisible power of God in his creation. But it's a sermon along that line. So that'll be September 2nd, Sunday night. So if you can be talking with your friends about it. It's something I'd been working on, and then I decided to see what evolutionists said about it, and I found one atheist begging other atheists for an answer to it, and nobody could answer it. So it's kind of an interesting thing. The other thing is, next quarter, there's going to be a class for people with children still in the house. Doesn't matter if it's a three-month-old or a 19-year-old. If you're still have some of your offspring in your house, would like you to be in that class. And to an extent, it's going to be kind of a roundtable workshop. We'll be going over some of the material that I've used in parenting series and stuff, but it's not simply presenting that material. We're going to talk with all the parents in the room at the beginning about kind of what direction and what some specific things you would like to make sure that we cover, and then we'll start working through that. So that'll be Sunday morning in the new quarter. I talked with Kevin about that some months ago in the scheduling. And as I said, that'll be for any parent who still has, regardless of the age, offspring, kids at home from babes to older teenagers, etc. If you would like to sit in on that as a grandparent, that's fine too. But at least if we can get all the parents in there. All right. So for the material this evening, this is going to be one of the lessons that was done over there in Indiana. And I want to point out two types of arguments. And by arguments, I don't mean arguments. I mean point, counterpoint. There are, you might call them offense and defense. Kind of like in football, what is a blitz? Is that an offensive play or a defensive play? That's a defensive play. What is a screen pass? That's not a defensive play. That's an offensive play. And so when you're engaging unbelievers, which was my topic up at Soul Camp this last week, sometimes you're going to be presenting arguments to them on why you believe in God. Other times, we need to be responding to the arguments they present as to why they don't believe in God. Now, sometimes those will cross over, but a lot of topics fall especially in one or the other. And we can also make one more distinction before we go further, and that is, as we're speaking, there's a difference between a Berean argument and an Athenian argument. A Berean argument is like when Paul goes to the synagogue in Berea, and he's talking to unbelievers in what sense? Jews who believe in the God of Israel and the Hebrew prophets, but they don't know that Jesus is the Messiah. So where does Paul present his arguments from? From the scriptures, because that's where they're already at. When he's at Athens, he's not talking to people that already believe the scriptures, and so that's not where he starts. He starts where they're at, their altar to an unknown God, and starts dealing with creation, which is something they could see. So keep those distinctions in mind. All right, so here's two friends a believer and an unbeliever, and one says, I don't believe in God. Why should I believe in someone invisible? And let me change my thing up here so I can see this better. And the other one says, doesn't intelligence design point to a designer? What about the ancient prophecies of Jesus? The unbeliever said, isn't the Bible just ancient Jewish mythology? Then how do you explain the empty tomb? Aren't the Gospels just legends from later times? No, the Bible reveals God's message to us. Which Bible, after so many copies and translations and versions, how can you trust that? So these were some of the topics that we were looking at. And the one we're going to look at tonight in giving an answer to those that ask is this one right here. And first we want to understand the skeptic's objection and then answer their objection. This is the one we're going to look at. Which Bible? After so many copies and translations and versions, how can you trust that? Raise your hand if you've ever heard had somebody make that type of argument to you. All right, so a lot of you, about half of you have heard, had somebody say that argument to you. Okay, so this is on our Bible Quest webcast that we do on Tuesdays. This is a comment we got from a viewer. English modern Bibles have been translated too many times. There are too many versions. Big enough differences to change the meaning. What agenda does each translation have? The average person, including me, cannot speak ancient Greek or Hebrew Aramaic, so cannot understand the original. And then they say, maybe no one really knows what's going on. And so, to understand the argument, here's the autographs. In other words, when Paul wrote Romans, after his scribe wrote it, and then he wrote the end of it by hand, and Phoebe took it to Rome, where's that manuscript? We don't have it. The letter to the Philippians that Paul sent back with Epaphroditus. He got it to Philippi, and we don't have that original one. When Luke wrote to Theophilus, you know, the first copy of Luke that went to Theophilus, we don't have that original one. We don't have the autographs, and that's pretty much always the way it is with ancient documents, by the way. And so what we have is copies of copies. So you have a copy, and there's copies and copies and copies and copies, and then you have variations in those manuscripts. Now remember what we're doing here. We're understanding the argument of the unbeliever. The unbeliever is saying, with all those differences, and he said, I've heard there's so many thousands and thousands of variations. And then you have the different translations. Latin translations like Jerome's, and Jerome wasn't the only one that had a Latin translation. You had Coptic translation, Syriac translation. And then your first, after Gutenberg invents the printing press, you have Tyndale prints the Bible in English. And of course, he's in trouble for doing that with the authorities that be, but he prints it in English. Later, King James authorizes, after several more translations like Matthew and Cloverdale, authorizes the King James Bible, which he as king authorized. That's why it's called the authorized version. It's not that God said, that's the authorized one. It was that King James said that. King James is a good translation done in 1611. But there's also the Jewish Publication Society's Bible. And it's quite different. What's different about the Jewish Publication Society's Bible? Main thing is it does not have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts. They don't have a New Testament in it. Why? It's published by religious Jews who use the Old Testament. They have the same Old Testament books that you've got in yours, but they don't have the New Testament books. And it's based on the Masoretic text of about 1000 AD. And then you have the Douay-Rheims version, which is a Catholic version. It does have some extra books, but only in the Old Testament. Catholic Bible has the same books you have in the New Testament. There's a few books in the Old Testament that you don't have, but they're not in the Jewish Bible, by the way, either. Some of it's like Jewish history, like the Maccabean Wars and stuff like that, not considered by Jews to be scripture. You've got the American Standard that comes along in 1901, the Revised Standard Version, the New American Standard Bible, the New International Version, the New King James, the ESV, which I've been using a lot and a lot of you use. And then you've got Hindu and Chinese and Russian Bibles and stuff. And so You know, if you're going to read a Bible, how would you know which one to read? Because they're all so different, the idea seems to be. So here's our 4 points we're going to look at here. Number one, is multiple versions an advantage or a disadvantage? Number two, a brief intro to biblical manuscripts. Number three, we're going to compare New Testament documentation to secular documentation. And then we're going to let you see how you can see it for yourself. I'm going to right up here show you websites where you can look at the ancient manuscripts, see it with your own eye, go in, click on the word, see what it is, and see it translated and everything right in front of your eyes. You can do it online anytime you want to. All right, so let's start with this one, multiple versions, advantage or disadvantage. Let's suppose, Jim, that you find out that somebody in your ancestry was, I don't know, they had a castle or they were a feudal lord or they were a pirate and they buried some treasure or whatever, but they wrote some family history about your family, but in a European language, okay? A different language, not in English. And it has lots of information in there about your ancestors, your family history, and everything else. It also tells about what castles they have and how they got those castles, and it also tells where they buried all the gold and silver. Now, what language might that be, Jim? What would your ancestry be? Pick German. All right, so it's in German. Jim, do you speak German?
Not
yet. All right. So, your buddy from college speaks German, and he says, I'll translate it for you. And he goes through and he says, I think it says it's buried by, and he gives you a translation. Do you want to stop right there? Okay, good. I want to make sure there's no other translations that confuse me. No, what would you like to do? It'd be interesting to get a German professor's translation, another German scholar's translation, and another. And if several all gave, that would be valuable to you. It wouldn't be invaluable. It would be, well, actually invaluable. It would not lack value. You'd be glad to have more expertise. And if there was a nuance in a word, oh, this could have meant this or that, that's something that would benefit you because what? You're interested in that, especially if you're going to try to figure out where the gold was buried and that type of thing. Shouldn't the most history-changing book of all time, broadly speaking over many centuries, shouldn't it be translated a bunch of times? Shouldn't the best-selling book of all times be translated over and over into a bunch of different languages? And as we find older manuscripts, let that information come on so we can get it, you know, see earlier and earlier. That's an advantage. That's not a disadvantage. All right, let's go on to number two, brief intro to biblical manuscripts. Some of you went to the Bible Museum. There were several of us who went to the Bible Museum a few weeks ago. And you remember the Gutenberg printing press that they had there? Except it was more like this. I was surprised how much force they used. You know, they would put the ink on, they would put that thing down, then they would turn that big thing and press it down and come off, and there you had one page. But that was fantastic because then you could put another sheet there and press that page. And all those typeset pieces, boom, now you've got a whole page. And then you do it again, boom, you've got a whole page. That really beat this by a long shot. So with Gutenberg's printing press back in the 1400s, now information could be passed on much more readily. And it made for part of the Renaissance that knowledge could just go. So you have a printed Bible, of course. Printing styles have changed, and so now I'm sure they use computers and printers a lot, but you know, there were times earlier, older Bibles, you would have had some typesetting and different things done. But regardless, those are on printing press. Before that, what did we have? Well, we had minuscules. The King James, when it was done, and Gutenberg's printing press was based on, would have been based on the Latin Vulgate. But when the King James was done, it went back to the Greek. But what Greek? They used Stephanus' text. Stephanus is the guy who divided it into a lot of the verses, you know, and did the verse numeration. Stephanus based his work on an earlier guy from the early 1500s named Erasmus. And what did Erasmus use? He used about a dozen or so manuscripts, and almost all of them were minuscules. Minuscule manuscripts are from the 9th century and later. And we've got a lot of these minuscules. And we also have some lectionaries. And so the minuscule type of writing is like this. One way you can date it is by the type of writing. I don't know if any of you have done this. I've done this sometimes for fun. Go into like an old bookstore, pick up a book, and you have to guess what date it was published just by the font. And if you look at a lot of old books, it's really kind of easy to do. If you pick up a book printed in the 1970s, think about what kind of font you're going to be looking at. There's just a look that fonts had in the 1970s that you didn't have in the 50s. There's a look from the 1920s that you didn't have in the 50s or the 1800s and stuff. And if you look at handwriting, if you look at a double S in the early 1800s, it looked more like two F's, like in the word assault, than two S's. That's just the way they wrote back at that time. Well, writing's been like that for a long time, and minuscules are kind of cursive, flowing, lowercase-looking letters. And that was what was popular from the 9th century forward. I've got it blown up there so you can see an example of it. Now, we have minuscule documents like this. This is Luke chapter 1. From the 10th century, so that'd be from the 900s. That's a page of Luke chapter 1. We also have lectionaries. There's a lot of lectionaries. Lectionaries were books that they would print up with Bible readings for the year. So here's a reading for this day, here's a reading for this day, here's a reading for this Sunday, here's a reading for this Sunday. And so it's copies of scriptures, but it's not just the whole text. By the way, you need to understand this. A lot of manuscripts were not the whole Bible. One manuscript might be the letters of Paul. Another manuscript might be Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, things like that. And something else might be Luke and Acts or something like that. So they're not, some of these manuscripts that you're going to see are the whole Bible, but a lot of them are a section. So that's a lectionary. That's a minuscule. Now, I need to speed up here. I got a slow start, and we also started late, but I'm going to start speeding up here. So we've got about 3,000 of these. We got about 2,500 of those. So that's about 5,500 manuscripts that we have that are from the 9th, 10th century onward. And that's what, for example, the King James is pretty much based on. A few of those. So that makes for about 5,500. But then this guy, Constantine Tischendorf, went looking for manuscripts in the 1800s, and he hit a gold mine. So you see in this valley there, in the Arabian Peninsula, see that monastery down there? He went there, and he was checking, and this is St. Catherine's Monastery. And it's a long story, I'll abbreviate it for time. He ends up eventually, he'd seen some pages and he could tell they were old and that they were from the Septuagint. Eventually, one of the monks shows him in his room. He says, I have one, and he pulled it out. And it is what is called Codex Sinaiticus. It has the entire New Testament in it from about 340 A.D. 325 to 350 A.D., maybe just a little bit later. The whole thing. There's some other stuff, too. There's some Old Testament books and some other writings. But all of the New Testament is there. This is a huge jump. Before this, the King James, at that time, Erasmus was working with things like from the 10th and the 11th century. Now we're back to like the mid-4th century, like 340 B.C. So this was a great find. And it is an uncial script. Uncial is large, bold, capital-looking letters, not in cursive. All right? And it dates from around 330 to 360 A.D. This, since then, we've found more uncials. This is an uncial from 200 AD, approximately. Now, as you can see, it's damaged. And so there's some letters missing here and there, but that's from Acts chapter 5, 12 through 21, from 200 AD. That's nearly 1,000 years before some of the manuscripts that Erasmus had used. This is a page of Codex Sinaiticus. That's part of the Sermon on the Mount there. Fantastic condition from just a little bit later than the other. And we found more. Turns out in the Vatican, they had one down in the Vatican. They weren't using it much, but it was there, Codex Vaticanus. And it's similar. And then another one, Codex Alexandrinus and such. And uncials go from about the 3rd century, about the year 200, up to the 10th century. And we've got about 300 of them now, which is really cool. And then they started finding something older. So they started finding papyri. You see, these are written on animal skin, on vellum, a very careful bookmaking process and in book form. But in the time of the New Testament, a lot of writing was done on papyri. What's papyri? It's where they take the papyrus reed from Egypt and they take some of the strands of the grass and they put them this way and they take some and put them this way and they smash them flat and make kind of a stiff paper-like material out of it. And now it's fibrous because, you know, you're dealing with natural fibers. And after it gets old, it gets kind of crunchy, we'll say. You know, it can get kind of brittle. But they found P1, papyrus number 1, in the 1890s, right around the time my house was built. Guess where it is? It's right here in Pennsylvania. It's in a museum over in Philadelphia. Joe Hamm, who's going to be speaking for us, and my brother and some others went and saw it one day. It's a very small section of Matthew 1, but some of the papyri are fantastic. This is one of the earliest ones. It's a little bitty piece from the Gospel of John. But it's very early. It's from about 125 to maybe 175 AD. Now keep in mind, John might have written, say, around the 90s. So this could be just 30 years after the original. This is Luke 3:18 through 24:53. It's also got John in there. This is from about 200 AD. Lately, some people have speculated a little bit later date, but for a long time it's been recognized to be about 200 AD. So we had these, about 5,000 of those. Then we got about 300 of these, and since the 1890s, there's been more papyri discovered, and now we've got about 139 of these. Now, you put all that together, that's a lot of manuscripts. And they're getting really close to the time of the original. Between 5,000 and 6,000 manuscripts, some as early as maybe 125 to 200. How does that compare with secular historical documents? Okay? Mike's smiling. He knows how this compares. How many here believe Alexander the Great really lived? That the Caesars really lived? And, of course, we've got all sorts of documentation right from their day and copies still existing from their day. No, that's not how ancient documents work. Let's take a look at Tacitus's Annals. All right, New Testament documentation compared to secular. We're going to be talking about the event, the document, and the copy, three different dates. So, like, Jesus died about 30 AD. Paul refers to the death of Jesus in Thessalonians about 50 AD. We've got a copy of Thessalonians from about 200 AD. So here's your event, and then there's a gap to the document of about 20 years, and then there's a gap to our first copy, etc. Watch this gap from event to document to copy, okay? This is the Tacitus of Annals, Annals of Tacitus. Got that wrong. So there's other sources too, like Suetonius. Suetonius tells us about the Caesars. But Tacitus is a really interesting character. He was a Roman senator, and then he was a historian, and his father was the Roman general that conquered Britain. Okay? So he was in the thick of things back then, and it's fascinating, some of the stuff that he wrote about. He wrote 16 books in his annals. Okay? He wrote around 117 AD. But the Caesars and the activities that he's describing go from 47 years earlier to 103 earlier, because he starts with Tiberius, who was the Caesar when Jesus was born. So he's writing in 117 AD about a guy that lived, you know, more than 100 years before. So we have an event gap, and you could stretch it from 47 to 103. I've kind of got it in the average there in the middle. That's your event gap with Tacitus. Now, out of those 16 books, we're missing those. And these, we only have partial. But of these top ones right there, 1, 2, 3, 4, and part of 5, guess how many documents we have of it? Remember, with the Bible, we have 6,000 almost manuscripts. Guess how many manuscripts we have for Tacitus's first half? One. But surely it's very early. Nope. It's from about 850 AD. But that's history. So, and then how about his second group? We have a few manuscripts, but all of the other ones are based on the first one. And that first one is from about 1050 AD. So look at your gap, and then a few later from that. For the first part of Tacitus' annals, you've got a 733-year gap before you get to our first written copy. And then you've got an event gap of an extra 47 to 103 years. So over 800 years gap. That's for the first part of Tacitus. For the last section of his books that we have, you've got a 1,000-year gap plus the 47 to 100-year gap back there. Now let's compare that with the New Testament. Here's the death of Jesus right here. Here's 1 Thessalonians written about 50, and here's 1 Corinthians written about 55. So your event gap is what? 20 to 25 years. Let's put that in perspective. How many of y'all remember when we had this building built? That was 14 years ago. Can anybody remember what happened 14 years? Yes. You remember the, what was it? The 2K bug. Remember that in computers? In 1999, everybody was worried that all the computers were going to go crazy when 2000 hit, because everything was scheduled for, and of course nothing happened. But you remember that? That's almost 20 years ago. 20, 25 years is nothing historically. That's very small. And what about our document gap? Well, we've got a copy of 1 Corinthians from around 200 AD. So when you compare, there's the New Testament. You've got so much more documentation for the scripture than you do other ancient writings. But historians realize other things are valuable because they give us history. The New Testament, we have so much more documentation on. And now we're going to finish up with a few things where you can just see it for yourself. Okay? So what we're going to do right here is I'm going to let you see Codex Sinaiticus. And let me see if this is it. Yeah. And we're going to back up so you can see the whole process of how to do it. Well, let's just start fresh here. Go to Google or whatever you want to use and just type in Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? And then right there at the top, you see CodexSinaiticus.org. That's it. You can click on that. And you see right here where it says see the manuscript? Guess what happens when you click on that? You get to see the manuscript. And so we're going to pick a passage. And I pick 1 Thessalonians 1 because it happens to start in the upper right side, upper left side of the page. So we're going to pick Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 1. And there it is. This is 1 Thessalonians 1. This is printed out in Greek, and this is a translation of it. And look what you can do. You can zoom in on this, and you can click on this thing right here, and what that's going to do, that's going to isolate word by word and separate. So we're going to go ahead and click on that, and we're going to zoom in on this a little bit more. We're going to use this tool right here and come in more. Oh, no. I just lost him. Let's see if I can get him back. Well, Boo's gone. Trying to demonstrate that it's easy to use, and then I blew it. All right. So let's go ahead and zoom in first. There we go. All right, we're going to click on this, and there, that's our first word. From the ink is a little bit dull right there, but that first letter is this. Can you see that? From math class. You remember what that is? Pi. So guess what that is? That's P. That next thing, what letter do you think that might be? That's an A, an alpha. That's A. And then that next letter, this thing like this, is the way they did a U. And then that next thing that looks like this is an L and OS. Well, that's the word Paul. And so you can slide over here, and there it is in a regular font form. Paulus, Chi, Sylvanus, Chi, Timotheus, to Ecclesia Thessalonica. Paul and Silas and Timothy to the church at Thessalonica. And you can scroll down here, and there's the translation. Paul and Silvanus and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians in Christ. Now you can come back over here. Let's yeah, here we go. So let's go back to this and see we can go through those words. There's Paulus, Chi, and Silvanus, Chi, and Timotheus. You see the T-I-M-O and then this thing with a line through it? That's T-H, Timotheus. And there's the word ecclesia right there. You've heard that word. There it is. E-K-K-L. This is an eta. It looks like an H in the capital. Sia, but it's an eta sound. Ecclesia. And then here's the word Thessalonica. So if you say, oh, who can know what was written? Well, you know, pull it right up there, and you're looking at a very early copy of the Bible, and you can look at the words yourself and say, well, I don't read Greek. Well, guess what? Slide over. Slide over here. There's the Greek where you can see it more clearly. Yeah, but I don't read Greek. Well, right down here, there's the translation, which brings us back to what you've got in your own Bible, right? All right. What about the Old Testament? Type in Great Isaiah Scroll. And go right down here to Great Isaiah Scroll, Digital Dead Sea Scrolls. There it is. If you've got a King James or a New King James Bible, or an old New American Standard Bible, or an American Standard Bible, when your Bible was done, You know what we had, you know what the scholars were using? They were using the Masoretic text. And a lot of them still will. The Masoretic text is a very impressive text. It's a Jewish text. That's the one, if you've ever read about, where the scribes counted the letters and made sure that all the letters were right. And if there was one mistake, they had to throw the whole thing away and start over. That was the Masoretes. That's not what all scribes did. That was the Jewish Masoretic scribes. All right? And our copy, our old copy of the Masoretic text, is the famous one, is the Leningrad Codex. Codex Leningrad. Now, it wasn't called Leningrad back in the day, but it ended up after the Soviet Union came along and the city of Leningrad got called that. And it's dated. It's got a beautiful title page that tells you the name of the scribe, Jacob, a Masoretic scribe, and the date he did it. So it's right around 1000 AD, okay? And that's what our Old Testaments were based on. A manuscript of Isaiah and other Old Testament books that was written 1,000 years after Jesus. Now, stick with me for just a minute, because sometimes this is the type of thing that can put people to sleep, but the next point is really worth it. So if you're asleep, wake up. If the person next to you is asleep, wake them up, because it's going to be worth it. 1,000 years after Christ. So let's take Isaiah 53, right? That passage, that beautiful passage in Isaiah 53. Isaiah lived 700 years before Christ. And our copy of Isaiah 53 was 1,000 years after Christ. That's a huge gap, right? Guess what happened when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls? They found their sectarian documents, like the community rule, where they buried the treasure, and all that kind of stuff. They actually had one about where they had the treasure. But they also had, and they had commentaries, like a commentary on Habakkuk. But they also had copies of the Old Testament books. And one of the most well-preserved of those scrolls is the Great Isaiah Scroll. And guess when it's written? Before the time of Christ. Maybe 150, maybe 200 years or so before the time of Christ. We'll call it about 150 years before the time of Christ. Which means this is over 1,100 years earlier than what we had with the Masoretic text. And you can get it right here. So here we're going to do, we're going to click to examine the scroll. All right? And so there's chapter 3, verse 14. This section down here, this isn't chapter numbers, this is the page numbers, because these pages are sewn together to make up a scroll. You go up to page 48, and that's where Isaiah 53 is. So here is chapter, nope, that's chapter 57, I went a little too far. Oh, remember, Hebrew goes left to right, so you have to go back this way. There we go, Isaiah 53. And you can just click on it right there. And that Hebrew right there says, who has believed our message and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? This says he was despised and rejected. This says he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And the punishment that made us whole was upon him. By his bruises we are healed. And it says, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned each of us to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This is over 1,000 years earlier than what we had before. I want to finish with this. I need somebody that has a New American Standard Bible to turn to Isaiah 53, verse 6. Or let's go with verse 5. New American Standard, I want somebody with the Isaiah 53, verse 5. Have it ready. Somebody with a King James Bible or New King James, turn to Isaiah 53, verse 5. One of you brethren will do that. And then if somebody has a NIV or a ESV, one of you brothers has that, turn to Isaiah 53, verse 5. So, who's got, which of you men has the New American Standard? Which of you men has a King James or a New King James? And which you men has an ESV or an NIV or something? Anybody? All right. read just the first phrase till you get to a point of punctuation, like a comma or something. What you're about to find out is there is more difference between your English translations, which is not a problem, than there is between the Masoretic text and the Hebrew text on this passage. Jeremiah, there's a lot of variation over 1,000 years. Okay, first phrase, Jim.
But he was pierced through for our transgressions.
But he was pierced through for our transgressions. Craig.
But he was wounded for our transgressions.
Ooh, you see some differences in the wording? I saw at least two wordings different there.
But he was pierced for our transgressions.
Ah. You had pierced, but you had pierced through. You didn't have pierced through. You had pierced. So already got several differences there. Next phrase.
He was crushed for our iniquities. He was bruised for our iniquities.
Oh, there's a different word.
He was crushed for our iniquities.
Okay, two of them are the same. One's different. Next phrase.
The chastening for our well-being fell upon him.
Three different words there.
The punishment that brought us peace was upon him.
Okay, a lot of difference there, but the same idea. You see, when you're translating, let me just illustrate this real quick. Suppose you're getting that document from your ancestor, and there's a word there that means a small body of flowing water in a little valley. Small. Well, the English translator can go with what? Creek? Stream? Brook? You know, there's lots of things. It doesn't mean, well, who knows what it was? Well, we have synonyms. And so your translation is going to have some variation. Let's do one more phrase.
And by his scourging, we are healed.
Okay.
And by his stripes, we are healed. And by his wounds, we are healed.
Okay. Now, they're saying, you've got the same idea in all of them. You have some different synonyms. Watch. You're about to hear the difference between the Masoretic text, that's over 1,000 years after Christ, and then our copy of Isaiah from 150 years before Christ. Ready? Here's the differences. And we'll start with verse 4. There's one difference in verse 4. You know what it is? The oldest manuscript has the word "and." And 1,100 years later, it didn't have the word "and." So, surely has borne our sufferings and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken and struck down by God. 1,000 years later, the "and" wasn't in a manuscript. All right? Verse 5. Two differences in the entire verse. You know what both of them are? The word "and." He was wounded for our transgressions and he was crushed for our iniquities. Over 1,000 years later, it just said, wounded for our transgressions in Hebrew, crushed for our iniquities. Didn't have a Hebrew word "and" in between. That's it. Now, as I said, if you get into Jeremiah text, there's some more difference and stuff. But the thing is, you can see for yourself. You can go and you can look at that. So, summing up, if somebody asks you this question, just share the information with them, you know, and help them think. For the most important book, for the greatest selling book of all time, the book that changed history, shouldn't we want it translated and have experts look at it? And if we get older documents, shouldn't that be valuable to us? And shouldn't we want it translated into all languages? And then let them see if you believe, you can do the same thing that we did with Tacitus on the Caesars with Alexander the Great or a lot of other things, I'm sure. And then let them see for themselves. I don't read Hebrew, but you know what I really like? I love being able to just look at that right there and being able to see exactly what that is. And so hopefully these things can be beneficial when somebody asks you that question. Thank you for bearing with me while I went through some technical things. And if you need to respond to the invitation, why don't you do so as we stand and sing.